and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekday at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. I'm Deal Hudson. My next guest is Russell Shaw. Russ is, I think, the preeminent Catholic journalist and commentator in this nation on matters about Catholicism. He's really a treasure trove of knowledge and experience. And if I had one thorny Catholic issue to try to figure out, I'd call Russ Shaw. Russ, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be with you today.
And you have a lot of experience that I think supports my praise of your life's work. You were, for 18 years, head of media relations for the Bishops' Conference.
That's right.
And for 10 years for the Knights of Columbus. That's 28 years at the top of two of the biggest and most important institutions in the Catholic Church in this country. And you've gotten 20 books to boot. So you are, I would think, just brimming over with brand new stories to tell our listeners today.
We shall see.
Now, your book that came out in last April from Ignatius Press is entitled American Church: The Remarkable Rise, Meteoric Fall, and Uncertain Future of Catholicism in America. And when I looked at it, Russ, it just reminded me of so many conversations that you and I have had in the past, both on the record and off the record, because you were essential to the book I wrote on Catholicism and politics a few years ago, guiding the history, for example, of the Bishops' Conference. And some of these years, fatal years, or if you want to call them fatal, 1976, that came up in your book. But I, you know, the big question, or the first question I want to ask you is this: at the core of your book, you ask the question, is America or the United States the hospitable place for Catholics, for the Catholic Church to take root and to grow? What is your opinion on that question at this point in your life?
My honest opinion is that right here and now, the answer, unfortunately, is no. It's not an hospitable place. At least the dominant secular culture is quite inhospitable. It's hostile to Catholic and indeed all traditional religious moral values and faith values generally.
But Rush, you go further than that. I mean, you get into an argument between Orestes Brownson and Father Isaac Hecker about in the 19th century, in the mid 19th century, about their disagreement on that very issue, and they really raise that question in terms of this country going all the way back to the colonies and the founding and something about the American character itself.
Yes, it's remarkable how that far back in the latter years of the 19th century, these two very insightful, very intelligent Catholic leaders, Brownson and Hecker, understood and anticipated the question which is vexing us now: can you be a good Catholic and a good American at the same time? Would you like me to say a word about Isaac Hecker and Orestes?
Yes, but I do want, of course, to tell our listeners that both Father Isaac Hecker and Orestes Brownson were both converts. That's just before you start talking about them. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
They were converts. Go ahead.
They were converts, and they were fascinating characters. Brownson was pretty eclectic in religious terms in the early part of his life. He was a religious seeker, and he tried just about everything in his quest. But he eventually settled down in Roman Catholicism, and he became what many people would today say the outstanding, the most distinguished American Catholic public intellectual of the 19th century, wrote voluminously journalism and also serious books, and his work continues to be read and studied and discussed in scholarly circles, philosophical and political science circles. So Brownson was quite a man. Isaac Hecker, as you said, was also a convert, younger than Brownson by some years, but he crossed Brownson's path at some point and became sort of a disciple of Brownson, and they came into the church about the same time, and Hecker attributed much of his conversion to Brownson's influence. Hecker soon became a priest not long after his conversion. He was ordained as a priest. He started with the Redemptorist Order, but he had a falling out with them, and went off to found his own religious order. He and a few other dissatisfied ex-Redemptorists. The order that Father Hecker founded is known today as the Paulist Fathers, and it was committed from the start, or anyway, it was committed in its founder's mind, to evangelization and to the conversion of the United States to Roman Catholicism. Hecker, who was an idealist and something of a dreamer, Hecker believed that Protestant America, back in his day, that is the middle years of the 19th century, was actually ripe for conversion to Catholicism. Yes, there were obstacles and problems, but he thought it could be done. And believing that, Hecker strongly advocated American Catholic assimilation into the larger American culture, on the grounds that in order to convert them, you have to be part of them, you have to be part of that culture. Brownson, his old friend, went along with that line for quite a number of years, but eventually he soured on it. Eventually, Brownson took a very different view on.
But how long did it take for Brownson to become dissatisfied with that approach?
Well, you could see it starting that changed attitude on Brownson's part starting to take shape in a review he wrote of a book by Hecker back in the mid-1850s. But I would say that apparently Brownson's attitude on this issue didn't really gel until the Civil War years, which he found the Civil War personally because of the death of one of his sons and also in a larger sense, perhaps. He found the Civil War a very upsetting, a very disturbing, and very disorienting experience for him personally. And it was then that, looking at American history and American culture as a whole, he became really jaundiced, really skeptical of Hecker's line that the conversion of America to Roman Catholicism was a realistic possibility. And in 1870, the two men had a remarkable exchange of correspondence, which I think should be much more widely known than it is, in fact, in which I cite at some length in my book.
Is that correspondence published in a volume, a separate volume?
Yes, it was. A couple of professors out at Notre Dame collected the correspondence in a volume published 10 or a dozen years ago. I guess it isn't a bestseller, but for those of us who are interested in
it's a must-read for anyone who struggles with these questions, especially we do in the arena of politics. So you sort of think that Orestes Brownson, in the end of the day, was correct. Is that right?
Well, I do. Brownson's argument was that, contrary to Hecker, there was something intrinsic to the American character, something built into the whole conceptual framework of the American thing, which made it radically incompatible with Catholicism, and that's what he told Hecker in no uncertain terms way back in 1870.
Wasn't there a contemporaneous heresy named by the Pope, by a Pope or two, called Americanism?
Americanism, yes. That it wasn't contemporary, though. It took another 25 or 30 years for the idea of Americanism to take shape in the Roman mind. But by the end of the 19th century, Pope Leo XIII had become very, very disturbed about what he and his close advisors saw as, a collection of odd ideas and strange ways of behaving, which the Pope chose to sum up as Americanism. Although the reality is, when you look into the story of Americanism, that it had a lot to do with events in France, not in the United States, where some of Hecker's ideas had been imported from the United States to France and perhaps rather distorted and exaggerated in the process. And in any case, whatever it was that Pope Leo XIII was upset about, he called it Americanism in an encyclical.
I'm talking with Russ Shaw. Sorry to interrupt you there, but I want to make sure everybody knows who you are. Russ Shaw, distinguished Catholic writer, journalist, commentator, and we're talking about his book from last year entitled American Church, The Remarkable Rise, Meteoric Fall, and Uncertain Future of Catholicism in America. But I want to kind of play devil's advocate on one of the points from your book, Russ.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You argue that the debate between Bronson and Hecker on whether or not America was a hospitable landscape for Catholicism was really decided, or at least proven to your eye, in the 60s, when the church with the culture began to have, you know, serious turbulence, overturning a lot of traditional views of morality and so forth. We don't need to explain that. Everybody knows it.
Sure.
And you call that individualism. American individualism sort of breaking through and really showing its, you don't say this, but I will, its ugly face.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this is a critique of American culture that I've heard from someone as authoritative as Cardinal George, that it's American individualism that is at the heart of this lack of hospitality or lack of, you might say, welcoming to Catholics. But when you talked about the 60s, I thought, well, this was a revolution, a cultural revolution that was not confined to the United States by any means. It was evident in Europe. And it's also a cultural revolution that, in its own way, has been experienced in Soviet Union, in perhaps in Japan, or wherever you look, you've seen this upward dominance of the power of the youth culture, the pop culture, of drugs, sexuality, and so forth. I mean, what made the 60s in the U.S. any different than any of the other, say, explosions of secularity in other nations around the world?
Sure. Well, that's an excellent question, and I can't give a simple answer. You know, there are two ways of arguing this, one of the central points here, and I'm open to both ways of arguing. There's merit in both of these positions. One is that the argument that Orestes Brownson first articulated, namely that there's something in the roots of Americanism and the American founding principles which makes American culture incompatible with Catholicism. The other point of view is that no, the American founding and the American founding principles were essentially good and positive and in fact congenial to Catholicism, and from that point of view, the position taken by Hecker, you know, made perfectly good sense. Hecker and his supporters in the American hierarchy, I should say. But whichever point of view you happen to think is an accurate representation of the facts from a historical point of view, the reality is that in the 1960s, there was some kind of cultural revolution that occurred in the United States as well as in other places in the world, which radically changed the whole tenor and thrust of American and other countries' cultures as well, changed them in a way that made them increasingly hostile to increasingly incompatible with traditional religious faith, and specifically with Catholicism. Now, why single out the United States for commentary in this context? Why talk so much about American culture and the clash between American secular culture and Catholicism in this country rather than, you know, treating it as a global phenomenon? Well, first of all, I agree with you that there is a global phenomenon involved here. But secondly, I, in writing my book, I wanted to concentrate on the American aspects of the problem, and I think I do that reasonably well in my treatment of it.
Oh, well, I'm certainly not criticizing your book as a whole, but I'm talking with Russ Shaw about his reflections on Catholicism in America, its past, its present, and its what he calls its uncertain future. But what about the issue of the fact that the founding of America really took place during what we call the Enlightenment? I mean, all of Europe, all the philosophers, and even the theologians were in the midst of their own intellectual revolution, turning that was had a kind of incipient or implied or virtual secularism of its own, and maybe even an implicit individualism. And couldn't it be the case that America just happened to be founded at a time when that was the dominant direction of thought?
Yes. However, it could be the case, and that argument is certainly made and has a great deal of validity. However, someone like John Courtney Murray, Father John Courtney Murray, who thought and wrote a great deal on this subject, traced the founding principles of America back beyond the Enlightenment era into the natural law tradition, which Murray contended correctly, I think, was in many ways a Catholic tradition. So Murray, in his famous book, We Hold These Truths, argued strongly that Americanism was ultimately rooted in Catholic principles and Catholic ways of understanding reality, understanding human nature and human relationships. Whatever the truth of that might be, and I think, you know, it's another arguable position. Unfortunately, we have, generally speaking, as a nation and as a culture and as a world, lost touch with the natural law. Natural law thinking is still there if you look for it, but it's not by no means the dominant mode of thinking. And in the absence of natural law, we're in deep, deep water as far as trying to analyze society and analyze the nature of human life and all the rest of it. So supposing that we had, in fact, by the 1960s, lost touch with natural law thinking, and we're faced with a cultural revolution, we had a pretty serious problem on our hands, a problem which persists to this very day and continues to be worked out.
Well, it's certainly getting progressively worse. You named the year 1950 as the kind of high water mark of prestige for Catholics in America, 1950. And I, of course, think of that period as post-war America, and I think of images like Bing Crosby in movies where he's playing, you know, a priest, or the movie where Ronald Reagan plays the Gipper to Pat O'Brien Rockney. And I think of some of the best films of Catholic directors like Frank Capra, Frank Borzage, John Ford, which were themselves sort of drenched with a kind of Catholic sensibility. But you pick out a novel called The Cardinal.
Yes, yes.
Tell me, why is The Cardinal so important symbolically for that?
The Cardinal was a a book by a Catholic writer named Henry Morton Robinson. He didn't write a great deal else, but I guess...
Well, evidently he didn't need to.
Financially, he didn't need to.
Right.
Because he really struck it rich with the cardinal. Incidentally, the cardinal was a fictionalized and highly romanticized overview of the life and career of Cardinal Francis Spellman of New York. It's remarkable when you look at that book and you look at a biography of Cardinal Spellman. It's remarkable how many of the seemingly far-fetched incidents in the book were in fact things that happened to Cardinal Spellman and things that he himself did, as for example, a sort of cloak and dagger mission on behalf of the Vatican in the early years of the Church's conflict with Italian fascism. That's quite a story in itself. But the Cardinal, anyway, the book is a story of the rise through the hierarchical ranks of an admirable priest named Stephen Firmoyle. He's a Boston Irish fellow, as so many members of the hierarchy have been, and his career eventually culminates with his red hat and his elevation to the College of Cardinals. The book is set in the pre-World War II years.
By the way, I'm familiar with it from the film version.
Well, you saw the film version, too.
I mean, it's a very well-known film.
Yes, it is. And the book was a tremendous...
Starring Tom Tryon, who himself became a novelist.
Yes, that's right. Well, anyway, the book is set, the story is set in the years before the Second World War, the decades before the Second World War. But remember, it was written and published in the early years of the Cold War, and it's definitely a Cold War book. And the message which comes through in the book, the philosophical and political message which comes through in the book, is that there's a great clash underway between godless communism, represented by the Soviet Union, and fundamentally religious but kind of shaky a Western tradition led by the United States. And in this clash of values and belief systems, Christianity versus atheism, really, Catholicism is meant to point the way hand in hand with America. That's the message we're getting here.
By the way, the film I just looked up wasn't made till 63, which of course meant that it met a less receptive audience, both Catholic and non-Catholic, and but it did highlight the anti-communism and the Cold War. My understanding is, Russ, that it is, in fact, the case that American Catholic leaders spearheaded the protest of communist influence in the United States and so forth. Is that correct?
They were certainly very active in it. One of the most eloquent and outspoken voices on the subject in those days was that of Fulton Sheen.
And of course, Joseph McCarthy.
And Joseph McCarthy, yes. Cardinal Spellman was quite supportive of Senator McCarthy during much of the senator's early career. Then after the fall, McCarthy's fall, sort of inflicted fall as a result of his own character problems.
Yeah, he had drinking.
The cardinal didn't abandon, still on a pastoral level and a personal level. The cardinal continued to be McCarthy's friend and helped him privately behind the scenes. So, yes, in any case, American Catholics took a leading role as both as Americans and as Catholics in urging American mobilization to meet the atheistic communist challenge of the Cold War.
If you were a real cynic, Rush, you could argue that that spearheading actually supports your contention about American character and individualism. In other words, they were protesting against a tyranny of the Soviet style, top-down leadership, and it fit in with the fact that American character in general was not hospitable to hierarchical leadership, i.e. the Catholic Church.
That's an interesting analysis, Deal. I had not, frankly, thought of it.
Well, it's far-fetched, but it's a far-fetched analogy, but did you get the same kind of protest against communism from the character of Catholics in Germany or Italy or France? Did they protest with the same vigor and with the same kind of ideal derived from their national character? I don't know.
Well, of course, it depends on which Catholics you're talking about. In many cases, the answer would be no, but if you're talking, for example, about Pope Pius XII, who in many ways was the spiritual leader of the West's response to the communist challenge, yes, Pius XII was intensely anti-communist. That dated back to the pre-war days.
No, they were. It was the death of God in political form, right?
Right, that's right. Sure.
And the what I want to do when we come back from our break here in a minute is I want to delve in more closely to your discussion of the man you consider the greatest, most important bishop in the history of the church in this country, and that is Cardinal Gibbons. This is Deal Hudson. You're listening to Church and Culture. I'm talking with Russ Shaw, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Just carry your cross. That's a phrase I've heard many times throughout my life, especially while complaining about unjust and unfair people. Most recently, I've been expressing my frustration regarding people who are difficult, mean, or downright bullies. And as I was sharing with someone an ongoing problem with a certain individual, my friend said to me, "Just carry your cross." Now, his simple comments really had me thinking. Perhaps God put me in the situation to bring me close to Him. And instead of constantly complaining about how this person has and continues to wrong me, perhaps I need to carry the cross in silence. Sometimes we need to bind our sufferings with that of Christ as we carry our own burdens. So the next time you have the urge to express anger or frustration, just stop the complaining and carry the cross. This has been a Christ Center communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the communication evangelist.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton, host of Power from the Pews, and I'm inviting you to join me in Rio de Janeiro this Saturday at 1:30 p.m. or Sunday at 9:30 a.m. for World Youth Day. What is this famous event that draws millions of young Catholics from across the globe to celebrate their faith with the Pope? Tune in this Saturday here on Ave Maria Radio for Power from the Pews and find out.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. I'm talking with Russell Shaw about his recent book from Ignatius Press entitled The American Church, Remarkable Rise, Meteoric Fall, and Uncertain Future of Catholicism in America. Russ, in addition to setting 1950 as a kind of landmark year for respect given to the Catholic Church and to Catholics, you trace that back to the influence of the Archbishop of Baltimore, Cardinal Gibbons, who was Archbishop from 1877 until 1921, and that's a long time. That's 40 years. Tell us a little bit about Cardinal Gibbons. Tell us what we need to know.
To begin with, like so many of his colleagues in the American hierarchy of that day, and our day as well. He was of Irish ancestry, not a poor, but a humble background, I would say. He was born in Baltimore, entered the seminary in 1855, ordained in 1861, and his first, what shall I say, his first break, if you will, in starting to move up in the clerical ranks was when he became secretary to the Archbishop of Baltimore in that day, and as such helped arrange one of the plenary councils of Baltimore, which were significant 19th century gatherings of the American bishops to hammer out joint policy on a number of issues. He got something of a national reputation and national image through that role at one of the plenary councils of Baltimore. And when the Pope was setting up a vicariate, a sort of quasi-diocese down in North Carolina a few years later, young Father Givens was named the first bishop down there in North Carolina. His duties later expanded to take in the state of Virginia and the Diocese of Richmond. And then back in 1877 it was, he was named to Baltimore first as coadjutor archbishop, and then eventually as archbishop, full archbishop, after the death of the incumbent. Now, being Archbishop of Baltimore meant a lot then. It means a lot now, too, as a matter of fact. But it meant even more in those years because the archbishop was sort of the de facto primate of the American hierarchy. He was first.
That's very important. In other words,
very important.
He was considered the leader of the bishops.
He was the de facto leader of the American bishops, and the longer he lived, the more effective and widely recognized his leadership became. I would say, you know, his real emergence as a national leader of Roman Catholicism occurred during the Third Plenary Council of Baltimore, over which he presided and was perhaps the most successful and the most influential of all of those plenary councils that I mentioned. So from then on, there was no doubt but that the Archbishop of Baltimore, Cardinal Gibbons, was number one in the American hierarchy, and he was recognized as such not only by his brother bishops, but by the Catholics of the country, and indeed all Americans knew that.
Does his influence last until the 20s when he died?
I think so. As he became old and was in failing health, of course, he was less vigorous and less active. But the respect which attached to Cardinal Gibbons and remained enormous. And at the time of his death, he was praised by presidents and prominent figures and newspapers and media, praised to a fairly well and with evident security. People really respected the man, and with good reason.
Sounds like he came down, though, on the Father Isaac Hecker side of the question.
He did. Cardinal Gibbons was an ardent American patriot, and as well as a faithful son of the Catholic Church. And he believed strongly that Hecker was right, that the compatibility between Catholicism and Americanism was very, very real, that the United States offered a uniquely and a providential environment for the Catholic Church to put down roots and thrive. And he strongly promoted, did everything in his power to foster the assimilation of Catholics into American culture.
No one stood up and said there's a downside to what he was doing?
Well, that's an interesting story, too. Yes. People did stand up. There were within the ranks of the hierarchy, there was not by no means unanimity on this question of the assimilation of Catholics into American culture. And the differences definitely broke down on ethnic lines. On the one hand, among the leadership of the Catholic Church, the great assimilationists were the Irish bishops. Those, you know, like Gibbons and Ireland of St. Paul and others, the Irish were strongly in favor of Catholic assimilation into American culture. The opposition came from the German bishops or German American bishops.
That's interesting. There was a great
split between the Irish and the Germans throughout much of the 19th century. A split within the ranks of the American Catholic Church, and it's focused largely on this question of not whether, but how rapidly and how unconditionally to move ahead in the assimilation of Catholics into American culture. And, of course, on the assimilationist side, the Americanist side, the great leader was Cardinal Gibbons.
Who would have been his, say, major critic?
Well, that's difficult to answer. A number of German-American bishops who weren't as well known.
Was there something about the fact of the difference between the German immigrant and the Irish immigrant?
Well,
one
obvious difference was that the Irish came here speaking English, and
right.
The Germans, of course, came here either not speaking English or speaking it rather imperfectly. So the Germans remained attached much longer than the Irish to their cultural.
But the Irish also
back in the old country.
The Irish came as a very persecuted group, extremely so. And immediately experience anti-Catholicism from the American side. Did the Germans come for different reasons? I mean, I don't recall them being persecuted.
In fact, a lot of the German immigration took place at the time of the Kulturkampf, Bismarck's Kulturkampf in Germany, which was definitely an anti-Catholic enterprise on the part of Chancellor Bismarck. It was a hard period for the church in Germany, and one response of a number of Catholics was to emigrate, and many of them came to the United States. So yes, they'd had their own experience of persecution back in the old country, and they were looking, like the Irish, for an environment which not offered toleration and an opportunity for them to practice their religion freely, and they found it. They found it. America, was for the most part delivered on its promises that way, but also it delivered on a lot of anti-Catholicism, which they were.
It sounds to me, though, Russ, like the Irish kind of won that argument.
I mean, overwhelmingly at the time. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but people have done, what shall I say, statistical analyses of the American hierarchy in those years, in the middle years of the 19th century, and you'd see that while the overall numbers in terms of population, how many Irish, how many Germans, are not dissimilar, the Irish overwhelmingly were the dominant presence in the ranks of the hierarchy. So the Irish won that argument, what shall I say, numerically, statistically speaking, and they also won it, I would say, in conceptual terms. The assimilationist formula indeed became the prevailing formula for American Catholicism, and the one that continued to dominate well into the 20th century, and some people would say, and I would say, continues to dominate American Catholic thinking about the relationship to the secular culture. Don't fight it, join it.
I'm talking with Russell Shaw about his recent book on the American church, I should say the church in America, its past, its present, its future. Now, I do have one little bone to pick with you.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the famous speech of John F. Kennedy to the Houston Baptist Association during his campaign, 1960 campaign for the presidency.
Right.
And you tie it to the later moves of well-known pro-abortion Catholic politicians like Mario Cuomo and Ted Kennedy, and unfortunately we could name a lot. We could go on naming for the rest of the show. And you draw a line between those two. I'm wondering how, for you, how thick is that line, or is it just a kind of foretaste of what was to come? Because I think sometimes Kennedy gets too much criticism for what he was trying to accomplish in that speech.
Well, I don't mean to overstate my case. Call it a dotted line deal, okay? John Kennedy was not a theologian, and as far as I know, he had no intention whatsoever of standing up and defying the church, much less declaring his independence of the church. He did, as a brilliant, and he was a brilliant politician, he did what was expedient at the time. He was faced with an upsurge of anti-Catholicism during his campaign for the presidency, and he responded with this speech down in Houston, assuring an audience of Protestant ministers and assuring the American electorate generally that if elected president, he wouldn't be too Catholic. That was pretty much the message.
Now, wait a minute. Let's go back and capture this just for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Kennedy was being targeted by the Klan, by rabid evangelicals whose anti-Catholicism, they made no attempt whatever to disguise it. And he was being accused of, if he was elected president, he was going to be taking directions directly from the Pope over the phone and so forth. It was really crazy stuff.
Yeah,
and for him to go down and simply say, look, as president, I'm not going to be taking direction from the Pope in Rome, I think was a reasonable thing to say.
It was a reasonable thing to say, but he overstated his case. I mean, he specifically affirmed his commitment to absolute separation of church and state. And this is a term of art that means something. It's not, in his mind, it may just have been rhetoric, but in reality, it means the most extreme secularist sort of interpretation of the First Amendment to the Constitution. And that's what, whether he knew it or not, he was declaring his commitment to. And then he's set up a number of straw men, like taking orders from the Pope and the bishops. Well, the Pope and the bishops didn't want to give him orders and would not have done so under any circumstances.
He didn't bring that up. He was being accused of it.
Yes, and he might have said, you know, a little more strongly, that's nonsense.
How would his defense been any different from any other Irish Catholic Northeastern politician of his day?
I think, you know, he might well have said, but did not say, that any decent individual of religious conviction, no matter what those religious convictions are, is going to be strongly influenced in his or her view of the world, the human life, and public policy questions by the values and convictions that his religious tradition has.
But he made not even a feint in that direction?
Nope, he backed away from it, and he went. He faded in the other direction, if you will, and that's what I fault him for. I think that's what he should have said. And
isn't this the product of the project that Cardinal Gimmett started? I mean, isn't this
arguably it is. In any case, you know, that this is what I'm suggesting, that there's a continuity here, a movement in a certain direction over quite a few years. Gibbons is one significant moment in that movement. John Kennedy's speech in Houston in 1960 was another. And after Kennedy, you find the Mario Cuomos and the Ted Kennedys and all the rest who carried the separation between religion and conviction and behavior as a public official.
And of course, his father, Joseph Kennedy, he was a piece of work.
Oh, he was.
I mean, in some ways, the comparison. I mean, the son could have been a lot worse than,
you know,
given
you know,
his
Joe
father.
Joe Kennedy took seriously at one point in his life the possibility of himself taking a run at the White House. He didn't.
And he was very pro-Nazi on top of that.
Well, he was. He was. He was. He was quite a character. But he was. You know, he was behind John. Joe Kennedy may have wanted the White House more than his son did. In any case, both of them won it in a sense.
Well, so I'll accept your dotted line between Kennedy's assurances to the Houston Baptist Ministers Association that his Catholic faith was not going to have any kind of substantial impact upon his presidential responsibilities. But there is a big difference from that and what popped up in the, I believe it was the 80s, this sort of double conscience theory, this sort of divided inner person that you got. You actually, from the Mario Cuomo Notre Dame speech, it seems to me that that speech was the real watershed in terms of how your narrative connects to Catholics and politics.
Well, it was. Yes, I agree.
What year was that speech?
Cuomo?
Yes.
Oh, best I can do off the top of my head is around 1980, thereabouts.
Mm-hmm. It was the formal theological statement, not that Cuomo was a theologian, but he had Jesuits writing it for him, right?
Uh-huh.
Of why a Catholic theologian, it's 84, why a Catholic politician can ignore the strictures on abortion. Now, Courtney Murray had already, as you know, written the book which argued why contraception was something that Catholic legislators need not worry about. We can put that argument aside for a second. It's quite another thing, though, to create an argument that applies this kind of distinction, that meaning distinction between what a Catholic as a politician should be concerned about and what a Catholic as a politician need not be concerned about. It's far different to apply it to abortion.
Let me invoke the authority of the Second Vatican Council, if I may. You, to my mind, in the Cuomo speech and similar efforts made to enunciate a legitimate separation between the individual's private conscience and his or her behavior in public life, you have a painfully clear illustration of what Vatican II was talking about when it declared that the split, the dichotomy, the division between faith and life is one of the most serious errors of the present day. That's what's going on here. People who take that position are making the incoherent assertion that it's somehow morally and psychologically possible for them to live in two worlds, two dimensions.
Right.
That they have a private life in which one sort of morality prevails, and then they have a public life in which it's perfectly legitimate for them to act according to some quite different set of moral norms, and that's terribly destructive. And intellectually, it makes no sense at all. But,
Russ, in your book, you actually discuss an event in Detroit in 1976 called the Call to Action Conference.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Which, that's 8 years ahead of the Cuomo speech,
mm-hmm.
and it is 16 years past the Kennedy speech. But this Call to Action Conference you talk about, and I know you attended, correct?
Yes, I was there.
Yeah, so you're an eyewitness. It actually turned out it was initially sponsored by the Bishops' Conference. Am I right?
One of the great fiascos in the history of the American Bishops' Conference, yes.
But it turned out to be a big platform for dissent. Is that correct?
Well, it got taken over by activists and special interests and so forth. The bishops just took their eye off it, and they shouldn't have, And I think they were painfully surprised by the way it turned out. But I fault them for the fact that it did turn out the way it did. Shortly after that conference ended, I think I tell this story in my book. I was standing along with a group of other people from Washington, standing outside our hotel, waiting for the bus to come to take us back to the airport. And a bishop whom I knew pretty well back then, God rest his soul, he was really hot under the collar about the conference, and he saw me standing there, and he came storming over to me, and he red-faced, and he said, "Why do you people in Washington make these things happen?" And I was kind of hot under the collar, too, and my answer was, "Why do you bishops let them happen?"
How good for you. So you were very aware at the time of the significance of what you had seen in Detroit at that conference.
I didn't know it was going to have the staying power that it said. People still use that name, call to action, to stand for a kind of liberal progressive Catholicism. I thought it would come and go rather quickly, but it hasn't. It still lived in infamy, if you will.
We have a few minutes left, but can we talk about Cardinal Bernardin? And the story you tell, which you told me, and I related it in my book, and you talk about it again, I think, here in more detail, more helpful detail. It's going to be hard to get at this in just a few minutes, but let me set it up for you, and you tell me.
Mm-hmm.
So in the during the Ford administration, and at that time Ford was running against Jimmy Carter. Ford was
right.
Trying to actually win the presidency as opposed to, it landing in his lap after Nixon resigned, that a group of bishops went over to interview both Ford and Carter
right.
on the issue of abortion. This was post Roe v. Wade. And surprisingly enough, they didn't like Carter's answers. They liked Ford's more, and the then Archbishop, I think, Bernardin, as I think he was head of the conference at the time, is that correct?
He was president of the Bishop's Conference.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He actually held a press conference in which he expressed his preference for Gerald Ford, and that created a huge explosion. Certainly Bernardin was not known as a big Republican sympathizer ever, but in that case he did. He went out on a limb and said something nice about a sitting Republican president. How did that furor impact Bernardin going into the future?
Cardinal Bernardin was sincerely pro-life. I knew Cardinal Bernardin pretty well at one time, and I have no doubt whatsoever about his good faith commitment to the pro-life cause. And that incident back in 1976 was one very dramatic illustration of the fact that what he said and did was the product of his commitment to the cause of defending unborn human life. And he never abandoned that cause. In later years, he remained just as strongly pro-life as he'd been in 1976. But he learned something from the 1976 experience. And what he learned, I think, was that in a certain sense you couldn't look to conservative Catholics for support when the chips were down.
Oh,
I remember very well that I was the press spokesman, the media spokesman for the Bishops' Conference then, and we and Bernardin above all, we were standing alone, it seemed, against the full force and fury of the news media and the political establishment and all the rest. We looked around for supporters from you would have thought the American Catholic community, and we got no support. We got silence. It was just as if nobody knew or cared what was going on. I once said to an American Catholic scholar of some distinction and a good man, don't you know what happened in 1976? And I told this story about Cardinal Bernardin, and he said, "I didn't know that. I didn't know that happened."
That's amazing.
Well, I mean, it was a big story when it happened. And
I want to thank you, Russ, for being on our show, and I want you to come back because I want to come back to this and trace some of these threads and dotted and unbroken lines out some more, and on a future date. Would you do that?
I'd be glad to do it, Dale.
I want to thank Russ Shaw for being on Church and Culture and all of you for listening. Please join us again next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
When we wonder where God is during challenging times, we can turn to King David for inspiration. After being chosen by God to be king, he spent years on the run. Yet in Psalm 37, David writes, "Fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Trust in the Lord and befriend faithfulness." When we trust in God and befriend faithfulness, we have confidence in our relationship with God. Thus David can say in Psalm 26, "Prove me, O Lord, and try me, for I walk in your faithfulness." This confidence overflows in Psalm 31. The Lord preserves the faithful. Be strong, let your heart take courage, all you who wait on the Lord. By David's example, we know we can hold fast to our faith and trust that God is with us. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan, www.cbsmich.org.
One in three Americans deal directly or indirectly with alcohol or substance abuse in their lifetime. If you're dependent and contemplating help, start listening to Renewing Hope every Saturday at noon on Ave Maria Radio. Renewing Hope is an information gateway to overcoming dependency. Brought to you by the St. Gregory Retreat Center, they want to help. Send your comments and questions without obligation to Renewing Hope at AveMariaRadio.net. And all audio archives can be found at our website at AveMariaRadio.net.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
Jesus came to a Samaritan town and sat down there at the well. And a woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "How could you, a Jew, ask a Samaritan woman for a drink?" And Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew who was saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I shall give will never thirst." So the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, so that I may not be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." And Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come back." And the woman answered, "I have no husband." And Jesus answered, "Do you right, for you've had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband." The woman said to him, "Sir, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you people say the place to worship is Jerusalem." Jesus said to her, "Believe me, woman, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father, not here or in Jerusalem. But the hour is coming when true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth."